anyway, thank you for being here today. I have Captain Frank Morley here today speaking on the acquisition side of the F-18. So without further ado, let's turn your cell phones off and let's get it done. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. Well, welcome to Farnborough, everybody. First day, always a good one. Those of us coming from the United States are happy to have weather in the two digits, if I said three digits, and so a little cool, no sun, and a little rain is actually a good thing for us. So it feels good. It's not good for our grass back in the States, but it feels good. So my name's Frank Morley, call sign Spanky. I'm the Hornet Growler program manager for the United States Navy and Marine Corps. Been a Hornet pilot my entire life in the Navy, squadron CO. I was a test pilot. I was a test pilot on the first couple of years of development of Super Hornet as well. So a great opportunity and a privilege for me to have this job at this point, having the F-18 be such a big part of my professional life. And so I'm certainly excited to talk about it and share and answer any of your questions that we can. You all are obviously a very educated press that comes to Farnborough. I think everybody probably understands F-18 pretty well. I'm going to talk, I'll talk all three variants, F-18, the A through D, Super Hornet, and a little bit about Growler. We'll concentrate on the Super Hornet, but certainly they all fall within my purview, and we'll go from there. Okay, so if we go to the next slide, please. Standard disclaimer for these type of things. Next slide. So as most probably know, the F-18 in all its variants is very much the core. It is tactical naval aviation for the United States Navy and the Marine Corps today and for quite a few more years as we go. They fill our flight decks. We have on a carrier air wing, there's four tactical squadrons. They are all some flavor of Hornet variant today. Also, we are about halfway through the Growler transition, so the fifth squadron on the ship is now, most of them are now a Hornet variant, that being the Growler. And then in the course of the Marine Corps, very prevalent F-18 A through Ds alongside their Harriers. So Hornet, Super Hornet, and Growler is carrier aviation today where we sit. The production continues on all of them. We'll share those numbers in a second, or at least for Super Hornet and Growler. The Growler is out there now. It's made several squadrons have made its deployment. And in fact, the Growler is such high demand that last year, when we transitioned the first fleet squadron, there was a month time frame there where we had three fleet squadrons transition to Growlers. All three of them were on a deployment. I mentioned that at another thing. I think he remembers that. But really kind of neat fact, we had two expeditionary and the first carrier squadron out. So very high demand platform, very high demand mission, and certainly the U.S. is taking advantage and using that. The flight plan is a very big part of what I'll talk about that a little bit here later, but is a big part of what F-18 has been. It's a big part of the evolutionary development, which you'll hear me refer to for F-18, and it's a big part of where we take this airplane. And so we'll get into that a little bit. And then, of course, the naval aviation, the United States Navy, sees its flight deck of the 2030s, 2020s, 2030s, F-18, Super Hornets, alongside F-35 and the Growler. And so that's going to be our tactical force as we go well in the future there. Okay, next slide. So some stats there, but basically on the left, if you look at that, the A through D, still about half the fleet out there is the A through D aircraft, and they're alive and well and still plugging there with the U.S. fleet, both on our carrier flight decks as well as for the Marine Corps. We also still continue to produce the Super Hornet. That's still well into production, and they roll off the line ahead of schedule every month as we go through there. And then Growlers, we're about halfway through our delivery, planned delivery for program of record for the EA-18G. So those continue to go forward. As many of you know, we have seven partner countries involved with Hornet. They're all seven having an A through D airplane, and the Royal Australian Air Force being the first Super Hornet partner on that. And on the right, this airplane being the being tactical naval aviation for the Navy Marine Corps today, certainly every bell, whistle, toy, bomb, weapon, sensor, computer, etc. that we're developing for tactical aviation is going to end up most likely being on this airplane. So down the left are the core items that are really part of the airplane there, and down the right are many of the weapons, the sensors, the boxes, etc. that also are integrated and go on to the F-18 today, and then as we move into the future as well. Next slide. So, when you kind of look at it, F-18, the Super Hornet, is in a very unique time in its life stage. And that is, and what this slide's trying to illustrate there for you, is that we are at a very high level of the latest capability that's being delivered, but we're at a very low risk and cost point on the airplane. And that's because of the evolutionary development that we've done on it. I'll show. I'll spend a little more detail in a second on it, but the Block II Super Hornet, the Super Hornet with the AESA radar, the integrated defensive electronic countermeasure suite, all the bells and whistles, advanced crew station, the advanced displays, all those bells and whistles came in the Block II Super Hornet, and that airplane didn't make its first deployment until 2008, and so that's important to understand. So. Very much a very new airplane with regards to the capability of the airplane, yet we've been building Super Hornets for quite some time, and so that learning curve is very mature for an airplane with that level of new capability. And so Super Hornet offers the United States Navy, certainly, and Australia and anyone else that's looking, it offers a very latest in capability that the airplane delivers, but it offers it at a very low risk from a cost schedule performance because of the maturity of the program there. And that's a unique time in the lifetime of an airplane, as well as the advantage of the evolutionary development that we've done with it. So that works out well. That's worked out very well for the United States Navy. Next slide. So it's important, as you understand what Hornet is, Hornet, Super Hornet, and then it's important to kind of put it in context of how the United States Navy fights. And what we bring what we have to the fight, right? It's the nature of a naval air force. It's the nature of carrier aviation. A carrier goes off, it goes to whatever part of the world it's called to do, it has what it has, and it's got to fight the fight that it finds and it's asked to do. Or whatever mission, whether it's a full-on open combat or whether it's some type of other type of mission there. So we have to fight with what we have, and so that's where you see the multi-role nature of the F-18. Really, you know, doing any mission, any tactical aviation mission that you would need or expect, the airplane needs to fulfill and has to do that at the highest of levels, because we may be the only one there initially for whatever we find in the world. And so there's that's where you get the flexibility in the mission and stuff. And then because of this airplane, it's replacing, as you all know, many different legacy airplanes. The Tomcat's gone, the A-6 is gone, not even on this. S-3 is gone. The Prowler's in the middle of its transition with Growler. And then, of course, the A-3Ds are slowly being replaced as well on that. And that all is taken up with the Super Hornet and the Growler. And then, as I said, alongside as F-35 enters the fleet. And that's where we go moving forward. So there's tremendous advantages of this as well. There's from a logistical, from a cost, from a sustainment standpoint, from a capability development that now applies to your entire fleet of airplanes, a lot of great advantages from that, from a cost, as well as maximizing the performance of your airplane. So that's where we're going. One thing I'll point out too, we know it, but sometimes we lose sight of how important that is, and that is the air-to-air tanking capability of the airplane, not that it can receive gas, but that it can give gas. Really a quite a force multiplier for the Navy. Gas at the carrier is obviously a big deal. We can't land when we want to land. We have to land when we have to land. And so there's that element of it, which is unique to carrier aviation. But beyond that, the ability to have every tactical airplane that you have available to you to be a tanker in whatever mix that you may desire and whatever mix that the mission may require is significant. So if you need to send four airplanes on a very long range strike and you have to support that organically without big wing tanking that might be around, well, then you can load up four other airplanes to be tankers and drag you all the way there and give you everything they can get to head back and maybe have a couple meet the other guys back. That's at the extreme. Or you could just have a couple of them to top off a division of airplanes in order to fulfill whatever mission or maximize their time airborne for a cap or whatever you need. The other thing we find with it is it's a tactical tanker. It's a tanker that can perform in a tactical threat environment area. So we've learned to live with that in some of the areas that we've been fighting recently because the threat's been low to minimal to none, in recent years in the countries we know. So we've been able to bring the big wing tanking over country and be essentially where we need them. But that has not been the norm, nor is that always going to be the norm. In most cases, in the way we lived prior to beating down Iraq and Afghanistan's air defense, beating down Iraq's defenses and having Afghanistan was that our big wing tankers, our tankers had to stay across the border. And so you would fill up, you would head in as far as you could head in, stay on cap for as long as you could stay on to have a meaningful combat load to commit, or go on station to either do a strike interdiction or to help close air support troops ashore or troops on the ground there. But then at some point, you'd have to cut it off. You'd have to fly out of country, hit with a big wing tanker, fill back up, and do it again. Well, now you have a tactical tanker that in those moderate threat environment areas can head into country. It can defend itself. It's got air-to-air missiles. It's got an AESA radar. It has the integrated defensive electronic countermeasure system. It's got all that. And so now it can fly into country. It can fill up at the big wing tanker out of country, fly into country near where the other fighters are operating, allowing those fighters to maximize their time on station, supporting troops on the ground, manning a cap, if you will, and then much shorter transit, fill up with those Super Hornet tankers, go back on station immediately without all that transit time, and then let the Super Hornet tanker run to the border, fill back up, and come back. And so we found when OIF kicked off, we actually brought more Super Hornets forward, and part of that was to fulfill that very mission on there. So oftentimes a forgotten issue, incredible force multiplier for us, the United States Navy, with a lot of assets to choose from, certainly offers a lot of options for others as well. Next slide. So I mentioned evolutionary development and how important that is, and this has really worked well for F-18, for the Navy, and for the Marine Corps, for the A through D Hornet. But it is really one of, I think, the lessons that we're going to pull from this program as it goes in the books as far as a very effective model of one way to do things. Okay, not saying this is the way you should do everything, but it is one really good way, and it's worked out very well for us. This slide goes even further if you want to talk about A through D and building the F-18 and then, going to the A and B, and then the C and D is the initial night attack version, and then a little further on some of the advancements we put in with the mission computer and stuff. But that, that was, as a whole there, the A through D is somewhat the normal progression what you see with airplanes. But then we recognized that we were starting to max out the A through D both in weight and what it could carry, in range and endurance, and bring back to the boat, all those type of things. So then we built the Super Hornet. But we built Super Hornet, and because of the needs of the Navy at the time, we needed to get airplanes out there in order to continue to fill the flight deck. So we built Super Hornet mainly as the new truck. And in fact, when I was a test pilot on that program, when we were doing it, one of the pitches was that, hey, and this is 90% common avionics with this latest C-D aircraft. And that was a good thing. That controlled the risk of the program, or controlled the cost of the program. It controlled the schedule of the program. And so we hit those bullets you see in the left. Hey, flies further, can fly longer, can carry more weapons, can bring back more weapons to the ship. It's a tanker, and it has enhanced airframe survivability improvements as well. So those were the big points that we hit on Super Hornet, and we didn't delay the program, we didn't hold the program, we didn't lengthen the program, and we did increase the cost of the program in order to develop the more advanced avionics systems, the ESA radar, etc., into that. Those were being developed on the side, independent of the schedule of the airplane. And so we brought the Super Hornet in, we developed IDECO, and we developed joint helmet mounted, you know, the JHIMX. We developed IDECO, we developed the ALE-50, all those type of systems, advanced crew station, we continued to develop, and then we fed those in as they were ready. And so starting with Lot 26 F-18s, we built those Lot 26 Super Hornets compatible for all those toys and started putting them in at that point. As we got to Lot 30, those airplanes now, everyone off the line, came with all those toys. And like I said earlier, then that first airplane with all those toys deployed first time in 2008. So a relevant capability, again, in controlled risk, cost, and schedule as we go. And then we did the same thing with the Growler. So we recognized we need a new AEA platform. The Prowler is getting old. The Prowler just had a very extensive upgrade to its Airborne Electronic Attack, or AEA, suite called ICAP-3. That had just been done in the earlier in the decade. And so we had a very old airplane with the latest in the AEA capability internal to the airplane. So the concept came, well, let's take the best AEA suite we have that's just been developed. Let's take the best tactical airplane we have that's just developed, the Super Hornet, and let's go ahead and just jam those together. And then that is probably a big enough first step to take with a big enough leap in what we need to do. So we did that. Again, control and risk, cost, schedule, delivered that thing on time with its first deployment last year. And now we have this ICAP-3 AEA system into most advanced strike fighter we have in the inventory there, with the ESA radar and AMRAAM and all that kind of stuff. And now you have everything the Prowler did plus more, because it's in a fighter, it's got all the links, got all the toys, it's got the ability to self-defend, it's got an ESA radar, AMRAAM, all that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, separately, we developed the next big technological leap, which is next-gen jammer. And so that continues in development, and as that matures and is ready, then that will be integrated into the Growler. And so that evolutionary effort continues. And then we continue on with the flight plan and all those development efforts in order to keep the airplane relevant. So a very good story. It's worked out very well for the United States Navy on that. And so I think that's important to spend some time on. And it's also important to understand, too, that given the software nature of machines these days, of weapon systems, of aircraft, whatever, the ability to continue to keep them at the cutting edge of the advanced technologies and stuff is pretty extensive. Every 2 years, new software, new load, some hardware changes, a lot of software, and you continue to take advantage. And so the airplane, and I saw that through in the F-18 A through D, as well as a little bit in Super Hornet during my time operationally flying, is every couple of years you come back to the airplane, and in a lot of respects it's a new airplane with the stuff that they brought in, not to mention the weapons and the advanced nature of the weapons coming. So that's that story. Next slide. So in that nature of how the Navy fights, and you've heard this I think before, but it is very important because it is, again, how we fight. We bring what we have to the fight. It's a multi-role environment, and we don't know what the particular enemy is, what the particular situation we're going to find ourselves in, and what area needs to be the most optimized. So, you know, we can't afford to have a point solution for a point type of a defense. So, the The Super Hornet story, the design, the philosophy on it has been this balanced approach to survivability and to lethality. So you take a combination of inherent signature within the airplane. You take the IDECM, you know, the EW type of defensive systems that you could put on the airplane. You put in standoff weapons of some sort, or any particular type of weapon, depending on the type of standoff, a variety of weapons, depending on what you need. And other things, and now you have the ability to be a lethal, survivable airplane in a majority of situations. Not only you combine that with Prowler or Growler in that EW, that AEA type of suite, and it's and with Link, and with be able to bring in other systems within the battle group and the airspace, and that's another important thing to understand too. One thing we're finding as we advance the next set of capabilities onto this airplane and others is that it's not just about the joust. It's not just about this system versus this system and how do they play. It's about this system with that system and that system and that system and how effective is it against this system and that system and this system, right? So don't quote me on that one. That's probably not a good quote, but it's a system of systems. Working against systems of systems. And we, the U.S., and I think are probably, well, let's put it this way. We spend a lot of time on that and looking at that because of the multitude of systems that we bring to the fight. And that's really where a lot of the gains, the tactical gains, and I think the exploitation areas in the future reside is in that systems of systems type of fight. Okay, next slide. And we only have a few more. I won't go through all this. This is the litany of what is Super Hornet on there. Basically, like I said, we come to the fight with what we have. So the multi-role nature of the airplane and the missions and the variety of the missions is covered there along the arc. And then you have the variety of systems that to play into that, whether it's the defensive systems up to the top, or the advanced displays, or the helmet-mounted sight, or the upgrading the mission computers, AT FLIR, the AESA, the IRST being in development now. We carry pretty much every weapon in the inventory, whether air-to-air or air-to-ground, again being the mainstay tactical airplane for the Navy and Marine Corps. They almost all are integrated onto the airplane, and these weapons are getting complex and bring a unique capability and a varied capability all into themselves, both air-to-air and air-to-ground. The Link getting more and more important, the sharp pods, reconnaissance pods, etc., all is a part of Super Hornet. Next slide. That's the litany for Growler. On there, one thing we find with the Growler and with this model that the Navy's chosen to go down is the synergies that come about with Super Hornet and Growler are and the gains from that synergy are quite significant. So everything we develop for the Super Hornet and pay for the R&D and the engineering and the integration, that by default is now a Growler capability. The only thing we have to then decide to pay for is retrofitting that capability into the Growler. If it's software, it's pretty much by default that it's going to go in. If it's a hardware type of thing, then we just need to make the decision if we want to put that box and procure that. But the R&D, the development, the integration effort's all done. So the synergy's there, and even back and forth, we'll see, I think, some of the efforts developed for Growler probably move be something available for Super Hornet as well as we move forward. So not only the logistics footprint and all those advantages, but the advantages of synergy of capability at a good price is very much part of that game, and we see that quite a bit. An example, the latest probably example, is a distributed targeting system, which is a new box and software going through operational tests now. On the airplane, being developed for many years, or several years. It was the EF capability to allow us to onboard, generate high-quality GPS coordinates at range in a very short time. And so that was being developed for EF. It was tracking along fine. And then we started looking at it, and the growler community started looking at it and go, boy, there's a lot of, that's part of one of our jobs. We have all these great sensors on the airplane in order to detect a sensor and get an idea where it is and put our AESA radar on it and then get a more precise set of coordinates. Man, if I can now take it that further step with DTS, now I can pass some really amazing coordinates to anybody. And that's kind of one of my roles I'm being asked to do, kind of that battle manager, if you will. And so that's that decision became a pretty easy one, going, okay, let's buy a few more boxes and throw them in the growler too. But the development's all done and the integration's all done. So that's going. Next slide. So the world we live in, a little bit of the systems of systems, a little bit about, it's all about taking information, any way you can get the information, transferring that information to whoever needs it, and then being able to put a particular weapon on a particular target for a particular user in a very short amount of time. And that's the world we live in. Even in the low threat environments that we've been fighting in the last decade, it's been about troops in contact, we need something now, and we need to put it in a pretty precise location so we don't risk friendlies or neutrals on that. So this slide kind of illustrates it. It's about the sensors, whatever you have there on board or off board, helmet mounted sight, the AESA, SAR mapping, AT FLIR, SHARP, reconnaissance PAW, whatever sensor you have out there, to be able to get that information, to transfer it, in any way that you can transfer it. We all know that the story on Link is far from written. And Link 16 is a wonderful system that we've got everybody kind of on the same page on that one. But just like your home computer, the demand for more pipe is never ending. And so that story continues to be written. But the Hornet and the Super Hornet uses Link 16 and other elements in order to pass information, to pass video, to pass screenshots, digitally pass close air support information, and you pass it on to whoever needs it, whether that's a special forces guy on the ground, whether that's an army unit, whether that's back to the ship, whatever. It's all about getting the information and passing it to the right guys very quickly so something can be done. And it's done in a digital, non-push-button way. So important stuff. Next slide. Flight plan. We quickly get into the classified realm and we start talking the details of the flight plan now. But this is again one of the things I think from the Hornet Super Hornet legacy will be something that will be one of those ways of doing business that'll be looked at quite favorably. It's more than just a PowerPoint slide, and certainly not this one. We have more complex PowerPoint slides on the flight plan at the right level, but it's more than just that. It is it's a construct of a pretty holistic look at where to take the airplane. So it involves threat analysis that's done within the Navy and DoD. It involves a gap analysis, so understanding the threat, understanding the capabilities that we have as a Navy, as a Air Force, as a country, and where those gaps are, and then determining what's best to fill it. Certainly, you probably want more than one thing to fill those gaps, but there's a trade-off there. Certainly, every arrow in your quiver doesn't have to be able to do everything. So there's a discussion about that, and this is all beyond the program. You know, very high level DoD and Navy type of analysis and efforts. And so as that is all farmed out, and we take that, look at what F-18 can do, and then look at what we need it to do, and what, you know, our country, our military wants it to do, then we're able to determine the pass to take it down. And then that's where the flight plan effort comes in, is where we vary in a systems engineering way, line out, okay, what capability do I need? What's the development path for that capability? How can I bring that in that evolutionary way so that I can gain benefits on this as we continue to build the complexity, continue the pace, or keep ahead of the threat, on these particular capabilities, strings, if you will, of development. What's the art of the possible? How do I tie in the S&T? How do I tie in what industry is capable of doing? And then matching that with our budget as well, and getting the support within the Pentagon, within the Navy, about that kind of financial support, and then tying that all into several development strings for as we advance the airplane. So, you know, we put out a major software load every 2 years on the airplane, which comes with a fair amount of advancement, whether that's internal to the airplane, whether that's integration of advanced weapons, etc. So you see some of the strains there. Targeting is, we talked the DTS, the distributed targeting system, but targeting in general, continuing to improve the sensors, continuing to figure out ways to put sensors on targets, on moving targets, on multiple moving targets in a very quick way, in more and more electronically threat type of environment or denied environment. The integration of that effort, because there's so much information today onboard and offboard coming into an airplane that information has to be synergized in a very clear way in order to make ROE decisions, targeting decisions, employment decisions, and pass that information in a digital, quick type of way because of the response times that are required now to get ordnance on target. Networking, we talked about the link story and where that's going, and then the weapons integration, because each of these weapons today bring tremendous wealth of capability in and amongst themselves. So that's when you hear flight plan, you hear Super Hornet, just realize there's it goes a mile deep in what we do. And I think, and so the Navy recognizes this airplane's around for a long time for us, and so the investment behind that is pretty healthy. We still are quite healthy in where we want to take the airplane, and I think if you take a look at what we've done to date and our record on that, it's pretty good on how we're able to put capability and continue to evolve the system of the airplane. So that works very well for the Navy. Next slide, and I think we're about out. So last slide on that, and we'll just stay on this slide, but because it's a cool picture. But that is I talked about it. It is Naval Tactical Aviation today. The flight decks are filled with Hornets and Growlers. You got the number of squadrons that we have out there today, and then these airplanes will work alongside JSF as it enters the fleet and as we go into the future. So that's the spiel on Hornet, Super Hornet, and Growler, and we'll now answer questions. Yes, sir. That's going through its initial operational test now, and so I think we'll start knowing the results of that. It's a pretty long OT period, complex weapons, so I think in the 2013-14 time frame is what we'll look at. It's integrated, it's been flying, it's been in test, and now it's in the final OT part, or the beginning of the OT part. I think so. Yes, and you would. I'll just caveat it with it's an OT now. I think that's where those we'll see those decisions. Not my program, so I would refer you to them to make sure you have the right dates on those type of things.
Boeing's briefed a number of enhancements at the same point. Engines, cockpits,
right.
Where is the Navy on maybe integrating some of those onto your radar?
Yeah. So cooperative discussion amongst that the. The particular ones you refer to, which are the international variant, if you will, is how you've heard that talked about from Boeing. The U.S. Navy is not committed to any of those yet for a domestic standpoint, but we cooperatively discuss and ensure the viability of those, and then we'll see where things go on that. But they're all enticing in some way, but no decision yet by the Navy on any one of those incorporated into our program of record. Okay? Yes, sir.
In addition to the boxes, there's still a number of platforms in APD-73.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those can't be upgraded with APD-79.
Right.
Get another sort of ESA that can be wrapped up.
Yeah, they're, of course, we know those AESAs are, in particular, Raytheon's Racer. AESA is certainly one that maybe not applicable for Super Hornet, possibly, but there are those options there. The Right now, our intent and our program of record is to retrofit all the way down to Lot 26 of the airplanes that didn't have the AC to start with. So that's first and foremost to put in to the down the Lot 26 all the airplanes that don't have AC that are capable of them on that. So that first and foremost that. In turn, that actually provides a lot of opportunity because that now frees up APG-73s to go into some of the old APG-65 A through D airplanes that are still around to enhance that capability. It provides an obsolescence pool of parts, et cetera, for the radar. And so that's kind of where we plan on going now. I think by the time we have that done, when you look at the particularly some of those older airplanes or those older Hornets and how much time we'll have left and everything, it'll probably be, from a business case, probably won't be what we'll do. But there certainly are options on the table if we chose to do that. We also continue to, you know, provide some level of development capability in the APG-73 as well, because we recognize we have a lot of those still out there in the fleet. Sorry, I'll get to you. Yeah.
On the total program, the Navy leadership has told Congress for several years that there's a gap or a shortfall in the number of airplanes they need versus what is actually going to be in the fleet.
Right.
What is that number today, and how does it track as far as the airplanes you're buying and the F-35 schedule?
Right. So I'm going to not tell you a number because it's told at a higher level, and I don't want to get it wrong, to be honest. But the number hasn't changed too much over the last couple of years. There is a number that we talk about where there's an inventory gap, if you will, and then we talk about our ability to manage that number. And so there are levers that can be pulled, inventory demands, you know, the way we move the airplanes around, spreading the pain around, that kind of thing that the Navy has felt comfortable doing to a certain number, okay? And we still exist in that. As we as in every service and stuff, look every year through every budgeting cycle about where do all the programs stand, when are they going to deliver, are they tracking on schedule, and what are our options? So I will tell you that this year, next year, every budgeting cycle, we look very carefully at many options, how JSF's doing, where Super Hornet is, and what that number is, how many levers have we pulled, and what should we do. So that is working its way through the process for this year like it does every budget year, and we'll see what the answer is. But we certainly look at all those issues.
And as a part of that, the Navy has been assessing some of the older airplanes thinking about potentially upgrading or extending their lives.
Right.
When you get those, I can't remember if they're A's or C's, at the other end of that process, are they going to be effectively the same A's and C's, or are you going to enhance them somehow with upgrades as a part of that opportunity to take them out of the fleet?
Right. So we do have a program of record. We do absolutely need to extend the life on a certain level of the A, and it is A through D's, mainly A's and C's. There are certain A airplanes that have had those upgrades that you talk about, so we certainly want to utilize those. So what you'll hear is the SLEP program, and you'll hear us talk about getting 150 of those to 10,000 hours, and that's 150 of the, and those airplanes are chosen for a reason based off of their useful, you know, their usage. There are many limiting factors on an airplane other than just flight hours. You know, your fatigue life in different areas, number of landings, number of traps, number of catapults, all these type of things. So you balance that along with the capability of those particular airplanes, whether they just had inherent, they're newer Cs, and so they have an inherent amount of capability, or if they were ones that went through capability mods and had, so you're picking your best of breed, if you will, both from a capability and a life, a airframe survival standpoint. And then those will be the ones that we quote-unquote SLEP in order to get to 10,000 hours. The rest of the fleet gets to 8,000 hours. We do what's called a high flight hour inspection, which is not as robust as the SLEP, but still kind of a you know, that type of work in order to get those beyond 8,000, but not necessarily to 10. So it's a combination of all that. Okay. Sir, did you have your hand up, or is it just the...
No.
Okay, I just want to make sure I didn't miss you. Yes, sir.
It's about the growler. Could you say a little about how the
Right. So probably a crawl, walk, run. A couple things. Certainly the community's desires initially was, boy, if I can just get this new airplane, get my crews trained, get it deployed, logistically sustain it, and do the same thing I'm doing with the Prowler, I'll be happy, right? And they certainly did that and figured that out even before they went on deployment. So that was step one. What we find, and this book is still being written too, but what we found is probably two things right off the top that are changing the tactics of how you employ an AEA platform. One of which is, because it's on an advanced strike fighter now with an ASA radar with all this stuff, is you can do different things with it. So there was a classic way we'd employ the Prowler at a certain distance away from the, in the back of the strike group with fighter cover and oftentimes and stuff, and then we'd have to tell it to turn and scram and stuff if a threat's coming through at different things. Well, now you have an airplane that can maintain its own situational awareness, can defend itself to a certain extent, and so now you can bring it closer to this fight and more tightly integrated into the strike package and then what it can do. And of course, anytime you move an AEA platform that's actively jamming closer is a good thing because of power and stuff. So the flexibility of how you design what it does within the typical mission has increased quite a bit. The other thing that came about pretty quickly was because of its combining both the AEA passive stuff along with the inherent Super Hornet stuff, AESA radar, Link, etc., we're finding that it's becoming much more a battle manager. And so now we can listen with that ALQ-218 system, find an emitter, put the AESA on it, drop a SAR map, ID it via the SAR map, DTS comes in, and now this thing is locating things in a way that we never got out of the Prowler. So with target precise coordinates and stuff. So those two things right off the top are areas where that mission's changing on that. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. The demo's at 49 minutes, so enjoy. Okay. I appreciate it. Have a good week.